Hello and welcome to Radio Edutalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay, and on today's show we're going to be hearing from Angela de Britos of SILT, and we're going to be talking around about the role of subject coordinators in primary language education. So welcome to Radio Edutalk, Angela.
Hi David.
And to start off with, could you give us a kind of brief background to your career in education?
Yeah, I started off teaching TEFL while I was travelling around, and that, I suppose, gave me my first taste for teaching, but also for teaching of languages. I'd done my degree in French and Spanish with business studies, and so that for me was the first opportunity I'd had to actually teach a language, albeit English, but teaching language, and I enjoyed it so much, especially working with the younger pupils. So after travelling around and living abroad for a wee while, I came back and I did my PGC, as it was at the time, and that was with primary with a specialism in languages. And I, you know, enjoyed the course, got a job straight away, and soon found it was quite a niche market. I mean, I was teaching as a general class teacher. You know, I think it was 5 and 6 year olds that I had at the time. But because languages were up and coming, it meant that there weren't that many general teachers who had the skills. So I did a lot of, shall we say, going into other people's classes, supporting colleagues, team teaching, that type of thing. Then a role came up within the local authority as an advisory teacher for primary languages. And pretty early into my career, I went into that type of role. So I was at school, my own school, 4 days a week, and the other day a week I was doing outreach within the local authority. Again, I really enjoyed that, and it ended up, it was quite a large job. I was living in Plymouth at the time, where there are over 70 primary schools, so it's quite a lot to get around. So the four days turned into 3 days. And then at some point, the University of St Mark and St John in Plymouth approached me and asked me if I'd do a bit of input into their course, which was a real honour for me because that's where I had actually done my PGCE. So I returned, I suppose, as a lecturer, you know, an associate lecturer for languages teaching the primary PGCEs. Then after that, it kind of grew and grew. They wanted input into their undergrad course as well. And before long, they approached me and asked me if I wanted a job there. So I was working part-time for the school and local authority, part-time at the university. And I really enjoyed the atmosphere. And eventually, I took the leap and moved there full-time. So, I was the course leader for the primary languages, and that was for all of the generalist students, undergrad and postgrad, and also there were 2 specialist streams as well. So those were slightly different from each other because obviously the generic skills and the pedagogy of primary language teaching was something that we did with everyone. But then there were the 2 smaller groups who were, you know, who did have the more language skills and who had a much greater interest, obviously, in languages as because they chose it as an option. And those were the specialist groups. But I've been living down in England for quite some time, and for family reasons and other things, I suppose, we started to look for jobs back up in Scotland. And within a week, the job at SILT was advertised and I was having an interview and here we are. So I really enjoy SILT. Uh-huh. It's a really varied job, you know, across all the authorities and supporting, yeah, schools and practitioners across the sector. So yeah, it's really interesting what I do.
And we're going to hear from you in the next 20 minutes or so, Angela, about your master's research that you did a couple of years ago and into the role of subject specialists. Now, am I right in saying that the research was kind of primarily based in England, a site of phenomenal ongoing change, particularly in foreign languages?
Yeah, will they, won't they? Yeah, it was while I was down in England, and obviously from having been the subject leader in school myself at one point to then taking a more shall we say, strategic role across the local authority, and then moving into initial teacher education, where I was seeing lots of students and lots of teachers, of course, when I went out to visit schools. What struck me initially was that in some schools, languages were done very well, and in other schools, it was little or nothing going on. And it made me think, as I suppose as well, because I had the specialist groups who were, you know, very interested, motivated for languages, it made me question why the support that they were getting and why the motivation that they were experiencing in their schools that they were going into for teaching practice was so varied. So that's what started me initially. You know, that's where the focus came from, really.
And can you just give us a bit of background then to what we know, what has kind of changed in terms of the politics, in terms of the demands from Ofsted and the government, and you know, even just the change in terminology and such like since the Nuffield report?
Yeah, when I first started my teaching career, it was languages were going to be the next big thing, and that's why they had a few courses that did have a specialism in primary languages. And it was always with this view towards 2011, 2010, that's when languages were going to be compulsory in Key Stage 2, so in upper primary, you know, from the age of 7, 8 years old. And that's what we were working towards under the Labour government. There was a lot of money ploughed into training, resources, and promotion of languages. You had organisations and bodies like Roots into Languages supporting at local level. You know, there was a lot of support. But with the general election and the change of government in 2010, what they said was that whilst reviewing the curriculum, they were going to, you know, shall we say, bench primary languages. You know, rather than implement it, they were going to hold fire and have languages as part of the bigger curriculum review. So therefore, all this momentum that had been building up and schools starting to put things into place and training, you know, developing and growing, it was like the pause button was pressed on it, pending review of the curriculum. And inevitably, what happened was that because there was so much support for languages and people really could see the value of it, yes, it did end up being implemented as was originally planned under the previous government. But there were a few differences. So in the past, it could be any language that you chose, whereas with the new curriculum, it was a choice of, you know, six languages, including Latin and ancient Greek. They were also not in favour of a carousel approach to languages. It was a mastery approach of one language all the way through Key Stage 2. And that was something different as well. And in terms of the terminology, well, another aspect was that they had lost the intercultural understanding objective, which of course previously had been a third of the objective. You had the literacy, reading and writing, you had the oracy, the talking and listening, and then intercultural understanding was that third strand that cut through and really gave a context for language learning. But that those intercultural objectives were removed in the new programme of study. And also, the name had changed to foreign languages. Hence, you know, given the fact that Latin and ancient Greek were being advocated, that it was no longer modern foreign languages, it was just foreign languages. So there were a few differences. I think as well in terms of Ofsted, I had never experienced either, you know, directly or even as an observer, Ofsted being very vigilant, or shall we say, of primary languages. Because it was always slightly out there on the periphery and people were just dipping their toe and starting to get into it. It wasn't really high on their agenda. Now, obviously, that's been about a year and a half that I've moved back up to Scotland. So perhaps things have changed. But one of the things that I definitely thought was, again, it's they were because they had given even more time to put languages into place, that momentum that had started and grown kind of petered out, and then it was trying to regrow and restart something again, which was more difficult, I think, second time round, because head teachers and practitioners had already started this for it to, you know, as pause. And then to start it again, I don't think it had the same credibility. And people perhaps didn't have the belief that this time it would actually be implemented for real. So what I was noticing in schools is that even though, yes, you know, new programme of study, new objectives, new title, new way of doing languages within the new curriculum, what it felt like was that in schools it wasn't actually happening that much, or perhaps it wasn't happening that well in the majority of schools. And I think partially that was because it wasn't languages weren't that high up the list of priorities for Ofsted. Not that I want the tail to wag the dog, but when you've got such a heavy focus on literacy and numeracy within the curriculum, it means that all the other subjects, the poor relations and just, you know, they're on the periphery, really. So part of me sometimes thought that maybe Ofsted needed to be a bit more serious about languages, and therefore schools and head teachers and governors down in England would start taking languages more seriously.
So with all this in mind, Angela, what can you take us through how you arrived at your research questions, and then a wee bit about your methods?
Well, in terms of the research questions, I wanted to find out, well, the reason I came to the questions was what I was seeing out in schools. And it made me think. I didn't start off with a hypothesis as such. It was, I suppose, a bit grounded theory, in the sense that this was happening around me and I didn't really know why. And I just wanted to know more about it. So I didn't start off really with thick questions. It was quite fluid. And I suppose it developed. I also used coding when I was looking at transcripts. And at the time, in hindsight, I would have used InVivo or some other software with it. But at the time, I did it all by hand. And so I had lots of scribbles. And if you look at the transcripts, I've got scribbles, I've got highlighters, I've got lines joining things up. You know, it was very, if I look back, perhaps it was quite immature, I don't know, but on the other hand, I felt as if it was hands-on in the way that that type of software can always be. So in terms of the research questions, what I came to, what were the changes to the National Curriculum Programme of Study for Foreign Languages, and what were the knock-on implications for teachers and schools? The next question was, what was the role of the subject leader in embedding outstanding foreign languages? And I chose the term outstanding because obviously that correlates with the Ofsted framework and performance management and review that you would get in school down in England. And my last question was, what was the best approach / strategy to achieving the outstanding practice in the foreign language? So, yeah, that was what I think. It was quite fluid, and it changed many times until we got to that stage. So, what I did was there were questionnaires that I sent out to teachers, and that was to get en masse data, you know, from a wider variety. And that was across Plymouth, Devon and Cornwall. Also did interviews, one-to-one interviews with, and they were semi-structured, with the AST ATs, the Advanced Skills Teachers for Modern Languages. Now, I suppose the equivalent in Scotland would be the development officers within the local authority. So those teachers who have got that advisory role for primary languages within their respective authorities. So I did that again across Plymouth, Devon and Cornwall. And I also interviewed my students. So that was quite an easy one to do. It was a bit of a captive audience. They were keen on languages and they were desperate to tell the stories and their experiences of what had been happening on teaching practice while they had been in school. So that was the methods and the tools that I used.
And can you take us through your findings?
Yeah, what I found out, there was a few things that were unexpected, shall we say, but I'll talk about those later. What I found was that in terms of what are the changes to the national curriculum for languages and what were the implications? It was really, that one was very mixed. With the advisory teachers and also the student teachers, with making the subject compulsory, they felt that was quite positive. They were pleased, they were happy, they were excited that languages were going to be playing a bigger role. But concerning the actual objectives and the content of the programme of study, it was much more negative. You know, they were worried about the lack of intercultural understandings. They were anxious about the growing role that phonics and this emphasis on reading and writing was coming. And disappointed was one of the other comments. They felt that this was the subject leaders. They felt that the programme of study had an overall lack of direction and that the objectives were too vague, they were too woolly, because previously the other framework had been broken down into year groups. So teachers knew year by year what they had to teach and it was very clear on how this progressed. Whereas the new programme of study for all subjects, not just for languages, was basically one page within the new national curriculum. And that was it. There was no further guidance. So they felt that this lack of guidance made the woolly vague. You know, there wasn't enough direction. They also felt that that narrowing the languages into... I said six earlier, it was seven actually. So French, Spanish, German, Italian, Mandarin, and then ancient Greek and Latin. So having it must be one of those seven languages. They felt that was very constrictive as well, and that it didn't take into consideration the expertise or within the school community or community languages, for example. So they felt that was a bit restrictive as well. Also, in terms of that mastery approach, one language over 4 years, it was 50-50, really. People could see the benefits of teaching one language over 4 years and having, you know, an in-depth knowledge and an in-depth experience of one language. Whereas the other half of my participants definitely felt that the experience in more than one language has its benefits in terms of the cognitive skills, the metalinguistic skills, and also it just experiencing different languages and different cultures. They felt there was a real benefit to be had from that. In terms of the intercultural understanding objective, it was unanimous that this was negative. Some went as far as calling it a travesty. They felt that you really needed an understanding of the world and cultures and countries around you for children's general knowledge and for the general learning and development, but specifically for languages, for it to set the context. One of the students commented that children will struggle to understand the bigger picture for culture, religion, and how these differ from the rural context in England, which obviously where she lived and where she had done teaching practice. And they felt that openly discussing intercultural dimension and the relationship between issues such as racism, sectarianism, terrorism, Islamophobia, that the intercultural understanding was a good forum to discuss issues like that, and it was being quashed, and that would only be to the detriment of the pupil. So in terms of the changes to the curriculum, that was my finding.
Now, obviously, within your research, Angela, you'd have done a review of the literature. So, bearing in mind that, plus your findings, what kind of conclusions did you reach, and mm-hmm. what kind of advice in terms of policy practice, but also kind of further research that would be necessary? What kind of conclusions did you make?
Yeah, well, the other findings that I had were in terms of the subject leader and their role. So that's quite interesting as well. And that correlated with the reading that I had done. So my next research question was the role. What is the role of the subject leader in embedding outstanding foreign languages? This, as I say, correlated with research. So, for example, Clinton and Vincent, 2009, Henry, 2012, who all saw the pivotal role of the subject leader or coordinator, whichever term you want to use, in terms of motivating and training the rest of the general school staff in a primary school, where you don't, we're jack of all trades, master of none. And I think everyone perhaps has their, a subject that they do feel more confident or stronger in. But for a lot of teachers, languages, whether it's French, German or Spanish, Italian, Mandarin, languages perhaps isn't that subject that they feel most confident in. So the training of staff and motivating staff, getting them on board, is a really crucial role of the subject leader. So I looked at the teacher confidence versus teacher competence. Now, that was quite easy to do down in England, where in schools and also in universities, in ITE, we grade teachers and we also grade students against the Ofsted criteria of outstanding, good, satisfactory, requires improvement, and unsatisfactory, as it was at the time. Satisfactory has now gone, so that's another change. So, but at the time, there were the five categories. So we looked, I asked the teachers and I asked the students to rate their confidence in teaching a language. And most of them, no one said that they felt outstanding in the teachers. No one said that they didn't feel outstanding in terms of their confidence. Whereas with the trainees who had done the specialism in languages, a quarter of them said that they felt that they were outstanding with their confidence. And so between outstanding and good, the huge majority of trainees who had in-depth pedagogy and extended language sessions, they had the confidence, and also from observing them in teaching practice, grading them against the Ofsted criteria, this was matched up. The two of them reflected each other very well. So that confidence that they had, it wasn't a false confidence. The proof of the pudding was in their lesson observations and looking at the portfolios of work and the children's work in classes. Whereas with the teachers in school who hadn't had as much training, they felt that it was definitely good and satisfactory. So in terms of findings, for me, it shows that there is a real need for more input in initial teacher education, so that people have the pedagogy as well as continuing with some language to keep their skills up and to keep it fresh in their minds. So that was one of the things that came out of it, that students who had the training were more confident and more competent in teaching languages than existing staff in school. One of the other things that came out of it was I suppose in what that meant was that it was the subject leaders, the main part of their role was about upskilling staff and growing the confidence, but also growing their skills in pedagogy and in the language. So the subject leader is a facilitator for the development of the subject, but also the development of their colleagues within school. Another thing that came up in the research was I asked the participants about the international dimension. So, for example, school exchanges, visits abroad, partner schools, e-twinning, the type of thing that the British Council support. That might be international CPD for teachers, etc. And one of the big initiatives that we had in Plymouth, which was due to local authority staff, was they really worked with the British Council to push the International School Award. So all schools in Plymouth had at that time International School Award at one level. There's beginners, intermediate, and the full award. So this seemed the schools that had the more internationalism going on in the school were the schools where they embraced languages more. And that was very difficult to tell. Is that it was chicken and egg. Were they more interested in the international dimension and bringing the international issues into the curriculum, not only in languages? Were they interested in that because the school embraced languages and that was the vision of the head teacher and the importance and the value put on the subject? Or was it the other way around, that they saw being in that international environment where people really did bring the outside world into their classroom and languages just naturally slotted in? So that was one thing that I never actually found out, which came first, but it was definitely evident that the schools where the best practice was going on and the most language teaching going on, it was happening in every class and the children spoke about it enthusiastically and the teachers spoke about it enthusiastically and students came back with, really good reports and good experiences on what happened in those schools. They were the ones who had more international learning going on. And so that, again, was a finding that came up. And that supports in terms of the reading that I had done, Driscoll and Frost, Jones and McLaughlin, that was 2009, I think. So they also believed that that international or global dimension supports and underpins language learning. And I suppose it's that interrelationship between the two of them. So, yeah, that correlated with what I had read as well.
Now, Angela, time's almost got the better of us, so a final couple of questions from myself. But this was obviously a couple of years ago, the research, now, and I'm just wondering how it assisted you as a education professional and where you've maybe taken some of the strands or findings or just the experience of research. And also it'd be really good to hear just maybe about some of the work that you're involved in with SILT presently.
One of the unexpected findings that I discovered was that when I was asking the students about their own, and the teachers actually, about their own qualifications in languages, there was no correlation. Now, I hadn't intended to look at this. It just, I suppose, naturally happened when I started gathering all the data, that there was no correlation between the teachers or say the practitioners, between the students and the teachers. The ones who got the best grading for the lesson observations didn't necessarily have the highest qualifications in languages. So just because someone had an A level Or just because someone had a degree, it did not necessarily mean that they were the ones getting the best lesson observations and the best gradings for the teaching of languages. So that showed to me that actually where it was higher was where the confidence was higher. So actually, now I'm not saying that, that subject knowledge isn't important. It definitely is. But the confidence and people's attitudes and values towards languages, even if you have got, you know, a standard grade or a GCSE from 15, 20 years ago, that you can make a very little amount of language go an awful long way. And so that really surprised me. And I think it surprised other people when I tell them about it, that there was literally no correlation at all between qualification in a language and supposedly subject knowledge and the actual teaching of it, them as a teacher and the learning that went on in their classroom. I think as well from the findings that, or I suppose my conclusion is that pedagogy and enough subject knowledge is really important, and that needs to be facilitated more at university level and at ITE, but also it's a real big focus for CLPL and the role that development officers from local authorities and the role that subject leaders play in this within their own clusters, within their own schools is really, really important. So that was my conclusions, really. And that leads really nicely into what I'm doing every day in SILT, because we support every authority in Scotland in terms of the teaching and learning of languages. And that's across the sectors, but primarily my focus is primary education. But we do a lot of cross-sector collaboration to share expertise. And so, yeah, I mean, on a typical day, I would be delivering CLPL. I could be up in Aberdeen, I could be down in the Borders. You know, we support every single authority in Scotland. But at the same time, strategically, we're looking at cross-sector collaboration and growing languages across the sectors. For example, in HE and FE, there's been much more of a decline of languages. And so promoting languages and changing those attitudes and values at primary level and ongoing into secondary will hopefully have that knock-on effect, whereby children and young people, young adults, see the value of languages and see it really as perhaps a basic skill that is transferable regardless of whether they end up being an engineer or a doctor or working in tourism or in hospitality. There are lots of things that you can do with a language. And so we really try to get that message across, working with parents, the wider community, government, the cultural organisations. So, that's what I'm doing at the moment. And it links in really well, actually, with my findings. But I think moves on in terms of practically being able to do something about it rather than just commenting on the need for better and more sustained CLPL. Yeah. In this role, I'm actually able to do something about it as part of our bigger team.
I'll just remind listeners, you've been listening to Angela De Britos of SILT. Angela, it's been absolutely brilliant having you on the show. Fascinating to hear about your research, particularly from one point of view, because I dabbled with a bit of grounded theory during my doctorate. And I didn't go with any fancy software myself, so I was smiling to myself at that point. I'm also, it's really interesting through your research in particular, this kind of quest for outstanding pedagogy and practice and outcomes, you know, which is really interesting coming from the English system. I absolutely commend you and your work. You know, I think you've really gone into a fascinating field, and I'm sure that your research and your findings will be having an influence throughout the UK and hopefully further afield. And you've really touched on a number of major issues and given us some pointers for the way forward. Obviously, listeners, if you've got any questions or comments for Angela, you can get in touch. You can contact us on Twitter at edutalker or on email, that's edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, and I'll be sure to pass on your questions and comments to Angela. Just before you go, what would be the kind of best web addresses for people to find out more about your work and the work of Sil and possibly to get in touch with you direct?
The my email address is angela.de-britos, which is BRITOS, at strath.ac.uk, and or you can have a look at the General Silk page, which has got lots of information about it. Language teaching in primary, secondary, beyond school. There's information for businesses, parents and carers, and within that page you'll find all my details there. And lots more about the work that we do and the other organisations that we work with. I think one of the best ways that people can keep informed about languages is to sign up for the SILT Weekly Bulletin. It's an e-bulletin that comes in every Friday to your inbox, and it's got lots of information about events, training, competitions, resources, lots of things that are going on that people have asked us to pass on to the wider audience. So that's one of the best ways, I think, of being informed. And it's completely free, obviously. But if you go to the SILT website, and you'll be able to follow the hyperlinks and even catch up as well on previous bulletins.
Thanks again, Angela, for taking the time out to appear on Radio Edge Talk, and best wishes for the future.
OK, thanks, David. Bye.